passion and commitment. Well, he went through a phase of that. He didn't stay with it. He did go back to law school. In 1771, he finished his studies at Strasbourg. And while at Strasbourg, he came under the influence of the leading thinker of that day at Strasbourg, J.G. Herder, H-E-R-D-E-R, whose dates are 1744 to 1803. Herder was revolting against the artificiality of neoclassicism. So that contact obviously was formative for Goethe. He received a permanent appointment to the court of the Duke of Weimar in 1775. By the end of his life, he was universally known. But he was also a very lonely and an isolated individual. Maybe because he was so looked up to that many people kept a distance out of respect for him. But though he had great fame, he was not a very happy and well-connected man. Goethe wrote numerous literary, dramatic, and poetic works that were marked by a high sentimentality that illustrates the principles of what's called storm and stress in German Romantic writing. You see this high sentimentality in his early work, 1774, The Sorrows of Young Werther. The Sorrows of Young Werther. There's a young man who is engaged in a hopeless love, an unrequited love, and he ends up committing suicide. Doesn't that just grab you? Well, I'm overdoing it, but you see, you know what romantic literature is like? It's that high sentimentality, the tragic hero, that sort of thing, The Sorrows of Young Werther. But the most, the supreme expression of romantic literature, as we see it in Goethe, is his famous drama, Faust, published in 1808 and then revised and published again in 1831. Goethe was interested in Spinoza's pantheism, in Leibniz's panpsychism, reality is made up of all these many centers of consciousness, and in Kant's aesthetics. And he was himself a considerable influence on J.C.F. Schiller, Arthur Schopenhauer, and Schelling. So I just want you to see the connections here. He influenced Schiller, Schopenhauer, and Schelling. We've already studied Schopenhauer, and the other two we'll mention in a minute. According to Goethe, convention should be defied in the interest of spontaneity and inner authenticity. We love that kind of stuff, right? Hey, don't let civilization, get in the way of your being an authentic individual. That's a real romantic, pantheistic insight of Goethe. He valued the intuitive over the rational. According to him, man's gift is his ability to see the whole in its parts. Man is not just stuck, on isolated, fragmented experiences, but in the individual experiences, man is able to see the whole of reality coming to expression. That's the great intuitive gift that man has. Okay, so you need to know a little bit about Goethe. I said Goethe was influential in the life of J.C.F. Schiller. Let's look at him. Schiller, his date, 1759 to 1805. 1759 to 1805. In 1789, Schiller was made a professor at the University of Jena, J-E-N-A. There he wrote history, but also, and these are two important words, works, The Aesthetic Education of Man, 1793, and then a work on the sublime, 1793 to 1801. The last 10 years of his life, he became a very close friend of Goethe. The last 5 years of his life, he struggled with tuberculosis. Earlier in his life, before he wrote history and philosophy, he had been a dramatist and a poet, and later he returned to his drama and poetry and became the most popular favorite writer in 19th century Germany. In his drama, he was the spokesman for Kant's idealism. The central idea that runs through all of Schiller's drama is that of winning spiritual freedom from the bondage of nature, attaining to perfection by the relentless pursuit of your duty. What was his philosophy? Well, I'm going to boil it down for you into a couple of observations. First, Schiller said the world is unknowable. The world is unknowable. Of course, you should be sitting there as critics saying, well, then can you say that the world is unknowable? Can you know that the world is unknowable? Anyway, he said the world is unknowable, and that allows us to engage in free conjecture as to its nature. Since you can't know, hey, go ahead. What's your opinion? What's your guess? I hate that approach to thinking. We see it, you know, in what I think are liberalized approaches to Bible study. It's kind of like, well, what does this mean to you? You know, no one really knows. I mean, this is a great mystery. So what's your opinion? What's your opinion? Well, in a broader way, Schiller said, none of us can know what reality is, so you can engage in free conjecture. And that free conjecture is the locus of human freedom. And who best expresses the freedom to conjecture about reality? The poets. He said it's the poets that provide philosophers with their first principles. Ooh, what an insult. Smack, you know. As us philosophers, we have a tendency to make fun of the poets who say, poetry is just candy-coated philosophy. You know, you guys get your ideas from the philosophers and you dress them up and make them entertaining. Schiller returns the insult. He goes, no, you philosophers, you get your first principles from the poets. Aesthetics becomes man's key harmonizing agent, because in aesthetics, we combine form with the life of feeling. You could never have a work of art if you just had the life of feeling. But you don't have art if you only have form, too. You've got to bring the two together. So aesthetics is what harmonizes, is the great harmonizing agent. And then a second characteristic of Schiller's philosophy, he held that the aesthetic impulse is important in any philosophical account of human nature. If you're going to understand what man is, you need to understand the aesthetic impulse. All right, Goethe, Schiller, let's move on and talk about Schelling. S-C-H-E-L-L-I-N-G. Friedrich W.J. von Schelling, who is the epitome of German Romantic philosophy. His date, 1775 to 1854. Philosophical Romanticism kicks off from the starting point of Kant, that Kant said the self is always related to the phenomenal world, and the noumenal, ultimate reality, is unknowable by reason. Schelling begins with that and wrote produce the position that is considered extreme transcendental idealism. In fact, the title of his major work, published in 1800, is The System of Transcendental Idealism. In it, he holds that consciousness is the only object of knowledge. You see how Kant is being taken to an extreme? Kant said, consciousness is a combination of percepts and concepts the active mind imposes on them. And so we know some objects, but we can't know what the ultimate objects are. For Schelling, he said, the only thing we know really is consciousness. Knowledge of the objective world is only a limiting condition in the process of consciousness coming to full self-awareness. As we come to know ourselves, all you can know is consciousness, but as we come to know ourselves, the idea, the limiting concept of an objective world is part of the process of knowing who we are more. But we don't really know an objective world. Schelling influenced especially the English Romantic poets, primarily through Coleridge, and we see his influence in Wordsworth and Shelley, particularly. Schelling felt that true philosophy aspires to art ultimately, because only in art can the mind become fully aware of itself. What's the only thing you can know, the only object of knowledge? Consciousness. How can you best know consciousness? Through art. Art unifies the subject and the object, which is to say, it unifies spirit and nature. You say, well, that sounds a little bit like Hegel. Spirit and nature being unified? Well, Hegel was a fellow student with Schelling at the University of Tübingen. And they even worked together as editors. Now, though no one holds this view now, in their lifetime, at least early on, many people thought of Hegel as a disciple of Schelling. I mean, that seems strange to us, because Hegel has this huge reputation now. In fact, many books on philosophy don't even mention, much less analyze Schelling. But in their day and age, early on, Hegel and Schelling were very close, and many people thought Hegel drew much from Schelling. Schelling had been the son of a pastor. As I said, he was trained at Tübingen with Hegel. And in between 1798 and 1803, he was a professor at the University of Jena, which was the center of German Romanticism. He was a friend of Schlegel's, Hegel's, and Goethe. Schlegel, Hegel, and Goethe. He later taught at other universities, but finally ended up in 1841 at the University of Berlin. A lot of what Schelling has written resembles existentialism with its importance of the individual. In 1795, for instance, he wrote a work entitled On the I as Philosophical Principle. I, first person pronoun. On the I as Philosophical Principle. Schelling was an anti-rationalist, as I've already indicated to you, held to the value of art and even mythology. He felt that people's mythology shapes their history and their creative potencies. He held to an organic view of reality and is what is called a vitalist. 1798, he wrote, On the World's Soul. According to him, nature is alive in all of its parts, and everything that's in nature represents a certain level of consciousness. And everything that comes to conscious expression, he says, was first unconscious. In fact, Schelling is the first to introduce this notion of the unconscious, which is picked up and popularized by Freud later. everything that comes to conscious expression was first the unconscious. In particular, it was part of our bodies that are in the realm of the unconscious. Everything that comes to conscious expression was first, then, part of our bodies. According to him, artistic creativity is explained by the interplay of the conscious and the unconscious in man. He held that the absolute, the ultimate reality, is, quote, primitive will, and it evolves. Primitive will, and it evolves. Well, it will make me feel good if you see the connection here. What two philosophers is that like? Reality is primitive will? Who said that? Schopenhauer, who said all reality evolves, develops? Hegel, right. So you have a kind of Hegelian Schopenhauer here. According to Schelling, God's essential unity involves an internal polarity. God is essentially unified, but inside the unity of God, there is a polarity between absolute and relative, necessary and contingent, eternal and temporal, potential and actual. All of these are polar opposites that are unified in God. In fact, he called God, and I quote, the eternal contrariety. The eternal contrariety. And you might put in your margins, go back to this when we get to Whitehead. And Whitehead starts talking about God, and within God there's this process of where you have polar opposites. Yes? Sure. Oh, everything is opposite. Well, all opposites are resolved in the aperon, according to Anaximander. Sure. The vitalistic idea that everything is alive is something that was held by most of the Milesian philosophers in one form or another. Hylozoism, very good. All is alive. All right, you have Goethe, Schiller, Schelling. Just a minute here on Schlegel before we look at Coleridge. Friedrich von Schlegel, 1772 to 1829, was influenced at the University of Jena by Schelling, Schleiermacher, and Schiller. And he particularly had an attachment to the works of Spinoza and Leibniz. I expect you all to be able to stand up in class and rehearse these relationships and get these names right. According to Schlegel, the spirit of objectivity dominates one's personality. When you are in the spirit of objectivity, the material you're studying represses and dominates your personality. And so he preferred, as the alternative, free expression of one's personality. That is, genius should dominate the material rather than the material suppressing your genius. You never have heard of von Schlegel, but you've heard of this theory, haven't you? Don't be so rational and objective that the material controls you. What's important is, what's your personal response to that? Be spontaneous. Let your genius dominate the way you deal with the material. Well, we have that presented to us in American culture today. That's the way we're supposed to write. The way we're supposed to think. Well, von Schlegel gave it expression long ago. All right, Coleridge, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, 1772 to 1834. Just to take one example of an English romantic poet, and the reason for that is that Schelling had such an influence on him and through him on the other English romanticists. We're going to turn the tape over and continue with Coleridge. Coleridge's dates are 1772 to 1834. As I've indicated, he was a romantic poet in England. He was also a theologian, a philosopher, and a social theorist. He was quite dissatisfied with British empiricism because British empiricism held that the mind is passive and operates by means of association of ideas. British empiricism, with that view of the passive mind, whose operations are a matter of ideas associated with one another, could never account for the psychology of artistic creation. So here this romanticist, as you might expect, is not satisfied with the British empirical outlook. Coleridge was one of the earliest English scholars to take an interest in the continental philosophy of Germany, particularly in the philosopher Kant, and as I've told you, Schelling. For Kant and Schelling, unlike British empiricism, the mind is active, and the operations of the mind, they felt, were better explained as, better explained with organic metaphors. You know, like the bud, the blossom, and the fruit, organic metaphors, instead of atomistic mechanical metaphors. Coleridge saw the British empiricists, like Locke, trying to explain the mind almost as though there are billiard balls, you know, externally related to each other, ideas. This one causes that one and is associated with this and so forth. The more organic approach are metaphors that are organic, he thought, were more adequate, and that's what you get in the German philosophers. Moreover, he was drawn to the German philosophers because he felt that their theory of knowledge would give rational support to Christianity. And although he found flaws in Kant's ethical philosophy, he was certain that Kant's deontologism, an ethic of duty, was closer to Christianity than utilitarianism as it came to expression in Bentham. We'll talk about that in a couple of days, or maybe tomorrow. Utilitarians say that moral decisions should be based on consequences, not on antecedent duties that are rational and universal. And so Coleridge was closer to the Germans, and he felt that, ironically, they could give help in rationally supporting Christianity. His social theory is found in the work of 1830 on the Constitution of Church and State. In it, he set forth a dialectical ideal of social harmony that is reached by reconciling the forces of permanence or traditionalism and the forces that want progression in society. He wanted the progressives and the traditionalists to be reconciled. So where would he get this idea of reconciling opposing forces? From Hegel. Very good. And this is an interesting connection you might not have guessed. Coleridge apparently exercised some influence on John Stuart Mill. Mill admitted that in an 1840 article in the Westminster Review. All right, so now we have just scratched the surface of Goethe, Schiller, Schelling, Schlegel, Coleridge. What we need to do is take a few moments to consider finally who was really historically earlier than what we were talking about, Schleiermacher. Schleiermacher's dates are 1768 to 1834. As Colin Brown will tell you in your reading assignment, it's probably appropriate to say of him that he founded not a school of thought, but founded an entire era. Schleiermacher's influence is immense. Schleiermacher was a German theologian with a pietistic background. What is pietism? A stress on religious experience. His father was an army chaplain. Both of his grandfathers were pastors. And so he grew up in a pietistic environment. As he went off to university, he believed that pietism had been discredited by the liberal intellectuals. And so what he ends up producing in his life, he would say, is a pietism of a higher order. It's pietism, all right, but it's secularized by the liberal intellectuals. Schleiermacher studied at Halle and was ordained in 1794. In 1796, he became minister of the Charity Hospital in Berlin. And during this period, he was drawn into the social circle of the Romantic writers, who were the intellectual avant-garde of that time. The Romantic writers with whom he hobnobbed stressed the role of mystery and imagination and feeling. In 1804, he went back to Halle, now as a professor. In 1809, he became minister of the Trinity Church in Berlin. The University of Halle closed, and a new university, which would become world famous, opened in Berlin, the University of Berlin, in 1810. And it was Schleiermacher who played a leading role in its foundation and setting up its theological faculty. Indeed, he was a professor of Christian dogmatics. Now, if you know Schleiermacher's views, I mean, I'm going to mention them in just a minute, but if you know them, you should be sitting there just trembling to think that a man with those convictions became the founding professor of dogmatics and the man who set up the faculty at the university, world-famous University of Berlin. Just amazing. In fact, he was the first dean of the faculty. For a while, he was the rector of the university. And he was the one who brought Hegel to the University of Berlin. However, after Hegel came, their relationship was strained because of the differences in their outlook. So, I mean, what an interesting time in history. Think about it. Hegel's at Berlin. Remember, Schopenhauer began to lecture at the University of Berlin to compete with Hegel. Schleiermacher's the one who brought Hegel to Berlin, and they had a falling out because their outlooks were so different. In addition to all of this academic and administrative work, you have to remember, though, that Schleiermacher preached regularly. He wrote a great deal, writing in systematic theology, hermeneutics, philosophy. He did translations of Plato, which were standard in German scholarship throughout the 19th century. And if you put all of his works together, they come to 30 volumes, and a good one-third of that is sermonic material. Schleiermacher's first major work, 1799, is entitled On Religion, Speeches to Its Cultured Despisers. On Religion, Speeches to Its Cultured Despisers, which is considered by most historians as the theological expression of Romanticism. In theology, that is the expression of Romanticism. It's an attempt to defend Christianity for the post-Enlightenment world, but it was not a restatement of biblical orthodoxy, neither was it an attempt to refurbish the enlightened moralistic religion of Kant. Instead, Schleiermacher took the view of defining religion as, quote, the sense and taste for the infinite. And he tried to demonstrate that any life without religion, a sense and taste for the infinite, is incomplete. The fuller statement of his romanticism in theology, and indeed the most important work of his life probably, was entitled The Christian Faith. Published in 1821, it ran to over 750 pages. In his expression of the Christian faith, Schleiermacher indicates that biblical details don't have to be taken seriously. It's not important whether the Bible is historically or scientifically true. He wanted to avoid the alternative of an orthodoxy based on revealed truth or a natural theology based on abstract speculation. Okay? So he doesn't want to go back to orthodox theology, but he doesn't want a Hegel or a Kant giving him his theology either. Instead, he adopted what he called a positive approach to religion. That word positive is important. We'll get to positivism later in our course. The positive approach to religion is based on a descriptive analysis of religious experience. If you want to understand religion, you need to describe it positively. Look at the experience of religion. And he tried to do that analysis and relate it to the essential elements of the Christian faith. According to Schleiermacher, the basis of religion is not knowledge and reasoning. It's not activity, morality. But there's something that underlies both the doing and the believing of a Christian, and that is a continuum of feeling or awareness, self-consciousness. And this idea of feeling or self-consciousness, a particular kind of it, that underlies all religious expression, all religious activity and behavior, is common to all religions, as a matter of fact. The common factor, the underlying factor in all religious experience is the feeling or the sense of absolute dependence. This general sense that I am not ausse, I am not independent and self-sufficient. I depend on something else. I depend on something transcendent that goes beyond me. That sense, in fact, the word sense is maybe better than feeling even, that sense, that generalized sense that I am a dependent creature, is the essence of all religion. And Schleiermacher then used that sense of absolute dependence to evaluate every Christian doctrine and to restate it in light of a more philosophically accurate or positive description of what it's all about. So it becomes a hermeneutical tool. Here he has this external autonomous experience that he's analyzed, and then he takes it to the Bible to interpret what the Bible's really teaching us about sin and God and creation and incarnation and so forth. As finite consciousness feels its dependence on the infinite, when the infinite is seen as a set of things, we call it the world. We feel a dependence on the world. However, when the world, or the infinite set of things, is taken as a unified whole, he called it God. Are you nervous? That sounds a little like pantheism, doesn't it? He says, what I'm depending on can be called the world, it can be called God. The world as individual things, God as the unified whole. And indeed, Schleiermacher admitted that the difference between Christianity and pantheism was a very fine one, a very thin, tenuous one. And so when Schleiermacher expresses his theology, the old theological language is used, but now filled with new philosophical content. The philosophical content of experientialism, especially the feeling of complete dependence, and an outlook which is vaguely pantheistic. Now I'm going to take one very important illustration of the redoing of Christian theology by Schleiermacher. What do we make of Christ if this is our religious and philosophical outlook? Well, Christ is no longer the incarnate Son of God in the traditional sense. Rather, Christ becomes, for Schleiermacher, a man in whom this feeling of dependence was complete. Christ was a man who had a profound experience of God through his sense of dependence. And his sense of dependence on God was so profound that that's why we say God existed in him. You see how it's this new hermeneutic? He reinterprets what the Bible says in light of his preconceived ideas that religion is a sense of dependence. Well, Jesus had that sense of dependence so greatly that we say that God was in him. And because of that, Jesus is able now to mediate a new redemptive awareness of God to the human race. Jesus' experience of God, complete dependence, becomes then his message to the human race. And that's why we call him the Redeemer. Now, what's missing here? Well, a lot's missing. But his notion of redemption does not involve any historical bearing of sin. I want you to have that in your notes. Meditate on that. Schleiermacher's romantic, virtually pantheistic version of Christianity, based on a sense of dependence, eliminates the historicity of Christianity and the notion of sin-bearing, guilt being atoned for by the particular man in history called Jesus. To put it very simply, Christian doctrine has now been forced into a Procrustean bed, a preconceived system of thought that is not based on divine revelation. In fact, divine revelation, the Bible, is made subordinate to man's philosophy, to Schleiermacher's philosophy. Who does that sound like? Hegel, right? Schleiermacher may have fought with Hegel, but they had this in common. They were in the same family of humanists who let their philosophy, even though their philosophy is different, dominate, subordinate, and corrupt divine self-revelation. Another Procrustean bed. And what we have in Schleiermacher epitomizes the liberal approach to religion, what is known as liberalism, religious or theological liberalism, that centers on man and his experience rather than on God and his self-revelation. Liberalism centers on man and his experience rather than God and his revelation. And so Schleiermacher is called the father of religious liberalism by many. Schleiermacher said that the highest religious activity or state is that of mystical feeling, the awareness of dependence. It's not morality, as Kant thought. It's not art, as Schiller thought. The highest religious activity is mystical feeling, communion with God based on a pious feeling of absolute dependence. However, God, according to Schleiermacher, is the identity of thought and being. That's the synthesis that all knowledge aims for, thought and being. And God is that synthesis of thought and being. But if God is the synthesis of thought and being, then God cannot be known. Why? Because all knowing dichotomizes, doesn't it? All knowing draws a distinction between being, which is perceptual, and conceptual thought that knows the being. It distinguishes between subject and object, if you will. So if all knowing is divided in human consciousness, but in God there is no distinction, then God cannot be known. It's very radical. Not only is the Bible set aside and reinterpreted according to his preconceived philosophical outlook, his philosophical outlook says inherently God cannot be known, cannot be rationally known. All religion comes down to what? A pious feeling of absolute dependence. And that is the heart of liberalism. Right, any questions about the Romanticists that we've covered so far? I've given you a general survey of romantic outlook, its hostility to reason, its view of reality, and we've tried to trace this in Goethe, Schiller, Schelling, Schlegel, Coleridge, and now especially important to us as Christians, the theological romanticist Schleiermacher. Okay? Psychism. Panpsychism. Yeah. When you go back and take the previous course, you'll know what I'm referring here. I can't take time to explain it. Would really monads, centers of self-consciousness, make up reality. It's wild stuff. Okay, the last person we're going to consider under the alternative access, going back to the board here, in the romantic section, is the subjective individualist Soren Kierkegaard. I'm especially glad to have one Danish philosopher to talk about, since Bonson is a Danish name. But I'm not so happy that this guy happens to be the representation of my homeland. Soren Kierkegaard, 1813 to 1855. As I've told you, he was Danish, born in Copenhagen. Kierkegaard was a frail and an especially melancholy individual. There's just no way around that. Everybody who reads him, everybody who studies his life, that was a center. I mean, he had a real down emotional experience. Very melancholy. He was physically frail. In 1830, he enrolled at the University of Copenhagen to study theology, but ended up reading a great deal of literature and philosophy, especially the German idealist, and particularly Hegel, whom he came to disdain, to put it mildly. When I ended my lecture on Hegel, you may remember my final criticism was the idolatry of Hegel. And this is what Kierkegaard came to say, too, although he doesn't say it the way I do because he has a different approach to Christianity. But he thought Hegel was utterly idolatrous, shameful, a corruption and destruction of true Christianity. In 1840, he became engaged to a woman, Regina Olson. And the only reason I have to tell you this is just about everybody who treats Kierkegaard recognizes that this experience of the engagement that was broken off seems to be really at the heart of his personality and the way he worked out his philosophy of life. He apparently became engaged to this young woman and then began to worry that he was relating to her in what he called bad faith, which is a real significant expression that appears throughout the 19th century and picked up by Jean-Paul Sartre later. Bad faith. Because Kierkegaard in his earlier days, he said, had in a moment of having been drinking too much, let himself go and he visited a prostitute. Now, I don't want to minimize the sin. In God's eyes, that is absolutely wretched. It's worthy of eternal condemnation, all right? So I'm not taking anything away from it. But most people who study the life of Kierkegaard can't imagine why that set him off so terribly. And he got to thinking, if I marry this woman whom I say I love, and she's marrying a man who has actually been unfaithful, then I'm not respecting her purity. But I can't bring myself to tell her that I have done this, because then she shouldn't want to marry me. And so he broke off the engagement, lest he live in bad faith toward Regina. She was heartbroken, pled with him not to do that, and within months returned to a previous boyfriend or suitor, became engaged, and married him, even though Kierkegaard had changed his mind. But he saw in that struggle, I mean, this kind of thing happens. We don't ordinarily rehearse this in a philosophy class. You say, yeah, okay, big deal. But it was an extremely big deal for him because it was a crisis for him to decide whether he would live in purity and true faith toward God, despite the dread that that represented, or whether he would give in to what were the desires, and I don't just mean sexual desires, but the lower level desires of having, if you will, a respectable life. An ordinary, cosmopolitan, urban existence. In 1841, he published his master's thesis entitled The Concept of Irony. And throughout his writing career, especially his early career, he engaged in a sustained polemic against Hegel in works which were usually published under a pseudonym. But he attacked Hegelianism in his treatises Either Or, 1843, Philosophical Fragments, 1844, and particularly Concluding Unscientific Postscript, 1846, where he presented his doctrine of subjective truth. Also during this period, and then on later into his life, Kierkegaard wrote books that directly set forth his Christian commitment. That word directly here is important. He wrote under a pseudonym, he said, to indirectly show the inadequacy of philosophy. But now that he's coming out to present Christianity, the only, good faith way to do it is under his own name. So now he directly presents Christianity and Christian commitment in particular. It's not so much Christian theology that needs to be presented, but the commitment of life that we call Christianity. Because the fundamental question, the starting point for Kierkegaard, is not what should I believe, but what should I do? For the subjective individualist, it's the doing, not the believing, that is the most important thing. That strangely parallels Schopenhauer, doesn't it? Schopenhauer says, man's life is desire, it's drive, it's will, it's practice. And Kierkegaard agrees that it's the practice, it's the doing that is important, not the believing, not the rational system that you develop. Well, the first of these books presenting his Christian commitment, 1845, Stages on Life's Way. Stages on Life's Way. Those three stages I'd like to rehearse for you real quickly. Kierkegaard says, man can live the aesthetic life, man can live the ethical life, or man can live the religious life. And these three give way to one another. The aesthetic life becomes inadequate and leads into the ethical life. The ethical life becomes inadequate, leads into the religious. Now, what characterizes these three stages along life's way? Well, the aesthetic life is the life of pleasure. The life of pleasure. You amass pleasures, even if they are artistic pleasures. They may be sensuous pleasures, hedonism. They may be refined pleasures, art. Who might he be referring to here? Who have you been studying? All these romanticists who say art and aesthetics is at the heart of coming to self-consciousness. And so Hegel is going to be attacked, but also the romanticists in their emphasis on aesthetics. All of that comes under the rubric of seeking pleasure. Well, aesthetic living brings us to ethical living. Ethical living is characterized by principles. Obviously, that's higher than living by pleasure. But the ethical life gives way to, you're really going to go all the way to be the kind of person you should be, you need to become a religious person, not just an ethical person. And religion, or if you will, commitment to the personal rather than principles or pleasure, commitment to the person or to the personal aspect of life, actually leads you, ironically, sometimes to go against principles and against pleasure. We'll come back to this. So that stage is on life's way, 1845. In 1843, he had written Fear and Trembling. in 1844, The Concept of Dread, probably one of the most profound psychological discussions of how dread is a fear of something to which we are drawn, and that's why there's a dread to it. 1848, Works of Love. 1849, Sickness Unto Death. 1850, Training in Christianity. 1851, For Self-Examination. And I haven't mentioned them all. But he wrote essays and treatises trying to present in various ways, not a systematic, rational proof or presentation of Christianity, but various ways to draw out from people the religious experience of becoming a true person and being committed, the doing of Christianity, not just the saying of Christianity. And to summarize Kierkegaard, we don't have time to go through as we have with Hegel and Schopenhauer. I'm just going to pick out some themes that are in Kierkegaard that, in a sense, typify his philosophy or outlook. And there'll be five of them. First of all, the importance of the existing individual. It's not systems that are important. It's not the universal that is important. Who would have said that the system that presents the universal is crucial? Hegel. He said, it's not systems and universality that we should focus on, but rather the individual, the existing individual. And the problem for the existing individual, according to Kierkegaard, is how do we find a focus and a center? That's his language. Focus and center. What should be the focus of my life? What should be the center of my life that will give meaning in the midst of a meaningless existence? That's the great question. The existing individual and what will give meaning, a focus and center to his life. I wish we had the time to talk more about this, because I want that to really sink in. That is very different than the approach of the rational philosophers like Hegel, but it's even different from the philosophers like Schopenhauer, who are at least trying to present a philosophy. Kierkegaard says, it's not a system of philosophy I'm giving you. It's Christian commitment, don't you understand? It's you as an individual that's important. And you need to find a focus in the center of your life. You can preach this, right? In fact, I think I am. I'm preaching to you now. You see, we get impassioned about this. And this is very appealing to Christians who should know better than to buy into the unorthodox philosophy of Kierkegaard. But you see, Kierkegaard is very pietistic, very evangelistic. I know people that I studied with in school, I won't mention names, but not just them, and many others, who really find Kierkegaard, I mean, these are evangelicals who think he's profound. He's the kind of philosophy you want to go with, because his is the philosophy impassioned commitment. That's what we want as Christians. Theology is not important. Creeds are not important. Apologetics is not important. You as an individual, your commitment, your decisions. Here I am, I'm preaching it again, right? You've heard this kind of thing, haven't you? It all comes from Kierkegaard. Well, not all, but Kierkegaard is the great vanguard for that approach to Christianity. The second thing we need to know about him is that his philosophy is characterized by an analysis of religious consciousness. His works delve into the nature of decision, the nature of faith, the nature of despair, the nature of dread. Kierkegaard stop to introspect and look at religious consciousness. And as I've said, sometimes many of the things he said were psychologically profound. And the guy wasn't completely a nutcase. And sometimes he said things about irony and about dread and so forth that you say, wow, yeah, that is really a profound insight to human nature. Thirdly, and I think maybe the most important thing you should remember about him, is his commitment to subjective truth. Subjective truth. Kierkegaard rejected reason and system, as I've already said. He rejected evidences and science. He didn't think religious commitment could be based on science, evidences. He didn't think it could be based on reasoning, the systematic presentation of a rational outlook like Hegel's. Because reasoning and evidences yield only approximations. Put that in quotes, that's his word. Only approximations. This is a real needling of Hegel. Because isn't that what Hegel said? Every perspective is only an approximation of the truth. Kierkegaard says approximations are not appropriate to Christian commitment. Approximations will not satisfy the greatest need of the heart, and that is for certainty. Evidences cannot satisfy the heart's desire, because the heart's desire is not for probabilities, but for certainty. And so over against this word approximations, which is the weakness of science, reason, evidences, Kierkegaard put the word appropriation. We don't need to approximate, we need to appropriate. We need to appropriate certainty in our lives. And so he was strongly critical of turning Christianity, the high point of personal philosophy and commitment, strongly critical of turning Christianity into a philosophical system, which is the terrible thing that Hegel had done. I'd like to read a couple of pages from W.T. Jones for you on subjective rather than objective truth in Kierkegaard, because I think he puts it so well, so succinctly. Jones says, Kierkegaard's distinction between subjective and objective truth deserves more detailed examination, for it plays an important role in defining his own view of religion and is highly interesting as a sign of the direction in which Western culture was moving. Catch that? Kierkegaard is not just showing us something interesting if you want to see Christian theology going down the tubes in a subjective way. It's Western culture that's moving in the subjectivistic direction. Jones says, as we have seen, this distinction was important to Kierkegaard because he held faith to be the essence of religion. But since he also held faith to be incompatible with objective evidence, it was necessary for him to show that all the so-called proofs of Christianity are incompetent. Here again, Kierkegaard may resemble Kant, who had undertaken to demonstrate that the three traditional proofs of the existence of God are invalid. But whereas Kant had criticized the proofs on logical grounds, Kierkegaard, see, is much more radical. Kierkegaard sought only to show that the mental state or attitude in which one is seeking to prove something is irreconcilable with religion. Do you all have a sense of how this is a much bigger step? Kant says the theological proofs are bad proofs. He has a logical criticism. Kierkegaard has something more profound to say. They have the whole mindset wrong. Proof isn't part of Christian commitment. It was a preliminary step in this undertaking that Kierkegaard, it was as a preliminary step in this undertaking that Kierkegaard distinguished between objective and subjective truth. The point of view of the seeker of objective truth is reflected in Kant's favorite image of the disinterested judge who, because he is not a party to the case, listens to plaintiff and defendant, weighs their evidence impartially and dispassionately. For the most part, philosophers have accepted this ideal of impartiality and have merely disagreed about whether it is actually attainable or whether men can only approximate to it. Most philosophers, therefore, have regarded words like impartial, disinterested, and dispassionate as highly honorific. For Kierkegaard, however, they were pejorative words. In his view, objective truth, like system, is an impossible ideal. There is no such thing as an impartial observer, for all truth is in varying degrees interested, committed. Impartiality is itself an interest, and as it happens, an unfortunate one. In the first place, pursuit of impartiality, which is doomed to failure anyway, is a distraction insofar as it draws our energies away from what ought to be our sole concern, and that is finding our center, becoming a Christian. In the second place, pursuit of impartiality is a form of escapism. Construing systems, weighing evidence, attempting to reach an objective truth are all subtle ways in which men seek to avoid the anguish of decision. Now, who does that sound like? Schopenhauer, right? Schopenhauer says reason can be a real obstacle. You need to be a man of action, make decisions, express your will. But when you reason, that gets in the way of it. In a similar way, Kierkegaard says reasoning is not something good. Impartiality is not something to be praised. It gets in the way of being authentic, being a true individual, expressing yourself and making a commitment. I'm going to stop the quotation at that point. And so Kierkegaard's philosophy is characterized by a commitment to subjective truth and really a disdain for, a sneering at the whole idea of objective truth. Fourth, Kierkegaard believed that certainty is found, this is paradoxical to be sure, but certainty is found in a passionate affirmation of what is absurd, particularly the absurdity of the incarnation and the cross. True certainty comes in passionately deciding to follow the message of the incarnation and the cross, even though they are absurd from the rational, intellectual standpoint. How can God become man? How can the infinite become finite? But that didn't dissuade Kierkegaard. In fact, he said, remember, subjective truth, not objective, that this all the more grips our heart, and we make a leap of faith. This is where the language of the leap of faith comes from. One leaves off rationality and objective truth and becomes an authentic individual in the leap of faith, which passionately commits itself to what appears to be absurd. And then this leads to the last characteristic before we get done with our lecture today, what he called the teleological suspension of the ethical, quote unquote. The teleological suspension of the ethical. A few moments ago when I referred to his work, Stages on Life's Way, I said the aesthetic lifestyle, pleasure, leads to the ethical lifestyle, living by principle, but that must give way ultimately to the religious lifestyle of being a person. And he uses here the example of Abraham. God required Abraham to sacrifice his intellect. How? Because God told Abraham, if you love me, kill your son. Now at that point, if Abraham were merely a man of principle, what would he do? He'd say, that can't be God speaking, because God's principles are being violated in the idea of killing my own son. The principles of ethics, but also the principle of God's promise, is violated. And so Abraham, the man of faith, sacrifices his intellect in order to be willing to sacrifice his son. Now, though this is not my theology and it scares me, you have to admit it plays really well. I mean, what a great metaphor. Abraham must first sacrifice his intellect, his principles. He must leave the ethical stage of life's way and take the plunge of the religious person who is committed to God even though it seems absurd to do it. Here the religious man teleologically suspends the ethical in order to gain the aim or purpose of life. What am I living for? Passionate commitment to God. And in order to attain that, to get a center and focus in my life, I must sacrifice my intellect, suspend the ethical and the principles connected with it. Well, where have we come now that we've looked at the alternative access response to the skepticism of Hume and the lack of certainty in Immanuel Kant. Yesterday, I think we saw in a really distasteful fashion, or we saw how distasteful the outcome of Hegel's rationalism is. The alternative access to being in connection with ultimate truth, whether it's through voluntarism or romanticism or subjective individualism, Kierkegaard's proto-existentialism, if you will, has brought us, and in Kierkegaard, even in its religious expression, to an extreme anti-rationalism that says it's not rationality, it's not system, it's not truth.